We have been hacked before, you guys, and we will be hacked again. But Congress might be doing something about it. The NFL might be coming to Los Angeles. And emojis might be ugly. No, they really are. Just saying. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 22nd of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And we will begin today with a story from the Marketplace desk of Where Have You People Been Anyway? Congress is finally getting to updating this country's cybersecurity laws. Years in the making, I think it's fair to say. Passed in the House today, up for debate in the Senate soon. The idea is to get private companies to share data about hacks and security issues with the federal government. No easy trick, I know. From Washington, Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons starts us off.
Cyber attacks are a unique threat. They're silent and invisible, and companies underestimate their risk. Take the breaches at Target, Sony, and Anthem. After those high-profile attacks, Congress is moving quickly on two bills that push for greater data sharing with the government.
Their focus on information sharing as some kind of solution to this problem is frankly kind of baffling.
Matt Blaze is a professor of computer science at the University of Pennsylvania. He says data sharing isn't necessarily the solution to the problem.
Which is that these systems are very weak to begin with.
You probably understand why they're weak. Think of how many times your computer or smartphone asks you to install a security update. Systems administrators also procrastinate. Another reason this is moving forward, lawmakers have addressed privacy concerns. Before anything is shared, companies must try to scrub out personal data. That's all well and good, says Mark Jacox of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but
what we've seen in the surveillance context is that the procedures don't actually protect privacy.
While the Senate still has to act, there is one proposal from the House Intelligence Committee to share this information with the NSA and the Pentagon. That could throw a wrench into the gears of the entire proposal, says Gregory Nojame, senior counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
That sounds a lot more like a surveillance bill than it does a cybersecurity bill.
Remember, after the Snowden leaks, internet giants like Google promised not to share user data with the government. Nojame says the NSA part of the bill may end up discouraging the information sharing it's trying to encourage. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Y'all can count me among those who signed up for HBO's new standalone service a couple of weeks ago. Game of Thrones will do that to you, I guess. Unbundling like that, as it's known, may well be the way television works in the not-too-distant future. But until that happens, Verizon is fighting back. The company's new product pitch goes a little something like this. How would you like to build your own TV bundle? Customers start with a stripped-down basic deal, add their choice of channel packs, one for kids, one for news, a couple for sports maybe. You see how it works. Not seeing how it works at all are companies like ESPN and Fox and NBC Universal, who are saying, in essence, pay me what you owe me. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more now on the ever-changing way we get our content.
Content producers like ESPN typically insist that their channels get included with basic bundles. Derek Bain is research director at SNL Kagan, which watches the media industries. He says they've got two very good reasons. One is ad revenue.
I mean, the bigger the number of subscribers you have, the more attractive you are to advertisers. They want access to the whole country.
The other is the licensing fees, which get passed on to consumers in the price of the bundle. Even if you never watch ESPN and you never see any ads, you're paying for the channel. Verizon says it's offering consumers a way out of that. Legally, Verizon probably can't do it. That's what the content companies say, and Laura Martin believes them. She's managing director at Needham Equity Research, and she thinks Verizon is bound to lose any legal fight. However, the company may have other goals in mind.
One goal Verizon could have is to tell consumers that it's not them requiring the huge bundle, it's these companies that are suing them, which are the content companies.
So, playing to the crowd. Or maybe Verizon is working the refs, signaling to regulators that the contracts are a problem because the bundles force consumers to buy stuff they don't want.
And Verizon's a champion of consumers. They're trying to do the right thing by consumers. And Washington, D.C. should look into these contracts.
Either way, she doesn't see the big pay TV bundle going away anytime soon. She doesn't think consumers actually care that much about reducing their TV spend. Netflix and Hulu took in about $5 billion last year, but consumer spending on cable didn't go down. We're spending more. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weisman for Marketplace.
It's Earth Day today, which means we're all hopefully being a bit more mindful about reducing and reusing and recycling. But one do-the-earth-a-favor practice is largely fading away, recycling glass bottles. What used to make city recycling programs a couple of bucks now actually costs them money. Some recycling programs won't even take glass now. It is just one more indignity suffered by a material that once made iconic products. Think, just for instance, the Coke bottle, designed so you would know you were holding a Coke even if you were blindfolded. It is, however, now one that quite a while ago we found wasn't suited for the modern age of convenience in which we live. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has that story.
Before we talk about recycling glass, let's start here.
The first question to ask is how much glass is being produced to be disposed of as a product.
Carl Zimring is author of the book Cash for Your Trash. Way back when, glass wasn't so much recycled as it was reused. Think about bottled milk.
So that when you were done with the bottle, you would give it back to the dairy, which would wash it and then fill it with more milk.
He says in the late 50s, beverage distributors started using bottles that were designed to be used once. Glass bottles were heavy, expensive, and expensive to transport, and they broke. So Coke in plastic bottles and beer in cans took over.
And that was absolutely deliberate to change the responsibility from the producer to the consumer.
Zimring says manufacturers from that point on had no incentive to care about what happened to glass once it left their distributors. Some states enacted deposit laws, but he says the beverage industry lobbied hard against more. There hasn't been new bottle deposit legislation in more than 30 years. Michael Munger teaches political science and economics at Duke. He says passing the buck, or in this case, the bottle, is just how manufacturers like it.
As soon as they make something, the packaging as well as the product belongs to someone else.
Even with recycling, that someone else often turns out to be the landfill. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Green arrows at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let me take you back to May 2010 and a couple of reasonably terrifying minutes in the world's capital markets. The flash crash, as it's now known, with the Dow dropping 1,000 points before recovering on May the 6th of that year, has officially been blamed on a London-based trader named Navinder Singh Sarau. Marketplace's Patty Hirsch is here for the what the heck actually happened anyway part of this story. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Kai.
What is this man then accused of having done?
It was a whole bunch of things. Wire fraud, securities fraud. But the thing that's most related to the flash crash is this thing called spoofing futures contracts.
And right about there, we need a definition of terms.
Right. So spoofing means fooling the markets. It's when you make it look like you're doing something when you're actually not doing something. So it feels like it might be time for an analogy.
Yeah, give me a real world or even a fake world example here.
All right. Well, let's take you to a real market. Okay.
£3 each, a 2 for £5 here tonight.
Banana, 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 banana. All right, there you go. Sound effects and everything.
Oh, there you are now. So imagine you have a stall at this farmer's market. That's actually you selling bananas.
Okay.
All right, and you're selling them for $2 a pound.
Yes.
Now, suddenly, this guy shows up beside you and sets up an empty stall, and he starts shouting about selling bananas at $1 a pound.
Yes.
There's no bananas there, but he's like, oh, the truck's just around the corner. We're going to be unloading them in a second. Line up for your bananas.
Right.
So, you know, customers start lining up. It's like all your customers are going away. So what do you do?
I go to 99 cents, man.
That's right. You drop your price, right? Yeah. Now you're selling bananas for $1 a pound and you sell a whole bunch, obviously a whole bunch of bunches.
Yep.
But you sell several boxes to a woman in a green hat. And suddenly you look around and that guy, he's gone. He's disappeared. There's no truckload of bananas.
Mine are up at $2 again.
Exactly.
I'm getting back in the market.
Bananas are back at $2 a pound. Then you get a phone call because your wife is at the other end of the market and she has spotted that truckload of bananas guy at the other end there, and he's selling bananas right out of the box, all right, helped by a woman in a green hat. What? You have been spoofed.
Tricked.
Yep. They forced you into selling your bananas at half price, and now they're back up selling them at $2 a pound and pocketing the profit.
And that is what this gentleman is accused of doing.
That's exactly right. And he made more than $800,000 doing it, according to the Department of Justice. He didn't have an accomplice either. He did it on his own using a very basic computer program to create and then sell those orders.
Okay, so that brings up another point. This has been linked or related to this concept of high-frequency trading, which we've talked about a whole lot. Mm-hmm. That's not what this guy was doing.
Well, he kind of was and he kind of wasn't, because he was competing with high-frequency traders using an algorithm, which is what, of course, high-frequency trading companies do. But he wasn't actually getting in there and doing the high-frequency back-and-forth trading that those guys do. The problem is that high-frequency traders kind of magnified what he did, because as soon as they see an aberration in the price, like they're going to pile on and take advantage of it. And of course, they did that. That magnified things. And a lot of people are saying that may have been what happened with this flash crash.
May have been. We don't know.
We don't know. And there's a lot of uncertainty here, not least because this spoofing activity is actually it's a daily occurrence in the markets. These high-frequency traders, in fact, all the time, they're putting out sell orders in order to see what's going on. They're small orders usually, but to see how the market will react. And then they pull those orders back. They cancel them straight away. So spoofing is like, it's a way that they do business. And the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and the other exchanges know all about this. In fact, they knew about this guy. In fact, they warned him off several times. So they were well aware that he was involving himself in this kind of business.
Does it not amaze you that a guy living in a row house just outside Heathrow Airport, apparently, can do this to the global capital markets?
It is amazing when you think about it. It's incredible to think that one guy on his own can do something so disruptive. And of course, that's why a lot of people are saying, well, maybe that's actually not what happens. Right. A lot of skepticism.
Patty Hirsch, he is our New York editor. Thank you, Patty.
It's my pleasure, Kai.
Last night in the city of Carson, California, about 15 or so miles south of Marketplace World headquarters here in downtown L.A., something happened that might change the face of the most profitable sports league in the country. The city council down in Carson approved a $1.7 billion football stadium to be shared someday by the present-day Oakland Raiders and San Diego Chargers. The fans in the room, as they say, went wild. L.A. Raiders, L.A. Chargers, if you couldn't tell what they are saying. This is, in point of fact, the second NFL stadium in Southern California to get the green light in as many months. The city of Inglewood approved a stadium for the St. Louis Rams back in February, and today a group of NFL owners in New York are going to get their first look at architectural drawings for both of those projects. Three teams possibly interested in coming to L.A. is three more teams than the city has had in 21 long, long years. But business-wise, maybe they really shouldn't bother. From KPCC, Ben Bergman explains why that is.
Almost 4 million people live in L.A., compared to 1.3 million in San Diego or 300,000 in St. Louis. But the thing is, in the NFL, bigger is not necessarily better. Just ask Green Bay.
Play. Rodgers is going to go to the end zone. He's got a touchdown. Randall Cobb.
Forbes ranks the Packers as the 13th most valuable NFL franchise, even though they play in the tiniest market. Victor Matheson is a sports economist at College of the Holy Cross.
It's actually surprisingly profitable to host an NFL team in small cities.
Because the NFL's, well, socialism makes it very different from other leagues.
Most of the revenue streams that an NFL team gets are shared equally among all teams in the league.
So tickets, the visiting team gets a 40% cut. Merchandise sales, all pooled. And the $6 billion a year money printing machine that is the NFL on TV, doesn't matter if you're in Jacksonville or New York, you get the same cut. Neil DeMoss edits the sports business site Field of Schemes.
In other sports, you go to a major market and you get untold cable riches, right, from having a local cable deal. And that's just not an issue in the NFL.
What is a big issue is public financing, which smaller markets tend to be more generous with. Politicians in San Diego and Oakland are scrambling to come up with plans to keep the Chargers and Raiders in town. And in Missouri, the governor has proposed extending state and local bonds to provide hundreds of millions in financing to keep the St. Louis Rams from returning to L.A.
If Missouri comes up and says, hey, we'll kick in half the cost, that's going to look awfully tempting.
LA isn't offering public financing, which helps explain why an NFL team hasn't played here for two decades. In the case of Rams owner Stan Kroenke, whose stadium proposal is the farthest along, moving west could get very expensive. The financing details are murky, but DeMoss says it's hard to imagine a scenario where Kroenke would be spending much less than $1 billion out of pocket. And that's not even including a relocation fee the NFL charges, which could tack on another billion.
I'm not saying Kroenke is absolutely bluffing, but whenever any owner in the NFL says, I'm going to move to LA and I don't care if I have to spend my own money, it's safer to assume bluff until proven otherwise.
So why would any NFL owner want to come to LA then? We do have nice weather, but more importantly, premium seats and luxury boxes. That money is exempt from revenue sharing, and owners use it to finance their stadiums. And there, LA does have a big advantage, says Scott Spencer, president of the Suite Experience Group, a luxury box reseller.
Individuals, especially in Hollywood, they want to be in the in spots, and so they're also going to want to be in suites at an NFL venue. And in St. Louis, it's just a little bit of a different mindset. And frankly, the businesses that are there just don't have the funds to spend on the expense of luxury suites.
Scott says that means the Rams could double the price of each luxury box if they were in LA and have twice as many boxes. He says having a nice stadium is important for keeping suites full. But the most important thing, winning. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
depending how old I am, I guess there'll either be a smiley face or a frowny face on the tombstone.
The guy who invented emoticons and what he thinks of emojis. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 88 points today, about 0.5%, closed at 18,038. The NASDAQ up 21 points, 0.4%, finished at 5,035. The S&P 500 up 10 points, that's 0.5% there as well, ended at 2107. Angie's List got a good review from investors today. The website, which allows users to rate businesses, reported a profit. Angie's List clicked up more than 4.75%. Yelp up 2% today. Boeing, on the other hand, did not take flight. The aircraft maker posted earnings that did not rise to expectations, and thus shares declined 1.33%. Other companies in the loss column today included Chipotle. The fast casual restaurant reported sluggish sales. Chipotle swallowed 7%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, a House Natural Resources Subcommittee holds a hearing to discuss how to protect national forests from the danger of wildfire. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March, and it's National Picnic Day. Plan your wardrobe accordingly. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. IBM reported profits this week. They still made a pile of money, but it was the 12th straight quarter, three straight years, in other words, of falling revenue. That said, they've got a plan, which Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, is here to tell me about. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so let's talk about IBM here for a minute, man.
Yes, it's an ancient company, Kai.
Yes, it has been around for a while.
But it wants to be much more than a hardware company, which is what we think of it as, right?
Yeah.
It wants to get into these new areas of cloud computing, data analytics, and it really has to do this if it wants to be an important company in 2015. So, Kai, I went down to IBM's Watson building in Manhattan this week, which is, you know, it's this weird glass building. There are no buttons in the elevators. It's very futuristic. You probably remember Watson from Jeopardy,
right? I did. Supercomputer, you bet.
Yeah.
Is there an actual Watson that you can look at?
No, because Watson, no.
I'm so underwhelmed.
So was I. But Watson is basically, as they say, in the cloud, which is a convenient way of saying, there's a bunch of boring, loud servers somewhere sitting in a room, blinking.
Fans are whirring.
Yeah, fans are whirring. But IBM wants Watson to not just deliver these answers in a Jeopardy game, for instance, but actually have a conversation with a person. They want it to be part of this phrase that they use a lot called cognitive computing.
Which means what? Because honestly, cognitive computing implies like thinking computers, which I'm not sure that's what, well, I don't want that anyway.
Not yet, at least, right?
Yeah.
So cognitive computing, I think of as the step before you get to artificial intelligence. Google Now, Apple Siri, Microsoft Cortana, these are all part of this idea. They're in this race to build a computer that can actually talk to you. You know, as we have a conversation person to person, you're really drawing on a ton of data and I'm drawing on a ton of data. There's this kind of two-way exchange of data we're having right now, Kai.
You make it sound so impersonal, Ben. So I'll tell you what. Give me like a real life example. You went down to this building and clearly they showed you around or something, right?
They did show me around, and I have an example for you. I talked to this guy in the Watson building. His name is Steve Gold. He's a VP there. He says that IBM is excited about how Watson could deal with medical data in ways that could actually rival your doctor or your nurse in certain situations. Take a listen.
All right.
Medical information doubles every 3 years, and in 2020, it'll be doubling every 73 days. Your doctor's not going to be able to keep pace with that volume of information. But Watson has a voracious appetite. It reads and understands all of this information in context and becomes this assistant.
So best possible outcome, Kai, you know that five-page form you have to fill out every time you go to the doctor's office? It goes away.
And better yet,
imagine not having to wait in the actual doctor's office. You know how you've got to wait in the front office and then you go into the back room where you sit on that giant piece of paper. It's kind of awkward and you have to wait around. Imagine actually you're having a conversation with a computer during that time. And then the doctor comes in. Then there's a three-way conversation where you and the doctor and the computer, I'm saying it could be the future, Kai. And it actually could be really good for helping the doctor understand the full context of the patient and getting a good prognosis and a good way to a cure.
First, do no harm. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
In that way that journalism sometimes works in this digital age, I saw an item online today and said, no, wait, we got to talk to that guy. It was on the website DigiDay, and the headline of the piece is all you need to know. Quote, father of the emoticon comes out swinging, I think emojis are ugly, unquote. Music to my ears, that was. So we called up Scott Fahlman. He is a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University and the aforementioned father of the emoticon. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Give us the quick backstory, would you, how the emoticon came to be?
Well, this was a long time ago. It was 1982. The internet was very primitive then. Just about a dozen universities hooked up. And we had just gained the ability to send email from one university to another. We'd had internal email for a while. And we had social media, and that was just sending email to bulletin boards where everybody could read them. So these kind of crazy, often sarcastic conversations would break out, just as they do on Facebook today.
Yeah.
And, you know, people would sometimes get bent out of shape. We would have these flame wars. Someone would say something meant to be humorous, and just one person out there doesn't get the joke and responds angrily. And so we felt maybe we needed a way to mark the posts we put up that were just meant to be humorous.
When you actually came up with these emoticons, did you turn your head sideways when you did it the first time, or did it sort of come to you conceptually?
You know, I was looking at the keyboard. People had suggested, well, let's just put an asterisk in the subject line if it's not meant to be a serious post, if it's meant to be sarcastic. And that wasn't intuitive. So I thought, gee, we could do better. I wonder if we could put a smiley face in the subject line. But we only had the simple ASCII character set, the sort of English characters and punctuation.
Yeah.
And it had to all be on one line so we could see it in the subject heading. And so I was looking at the keyboard, and what could we possibly use? And then there was the colon, and too bad it's sideways. But then I thought, well, you know, maybe people would turn their heads, and we could make a really nice face in that case.
And there you go. The gist of this article that I referred to up in the introduction is that you are not at all happy with the way emoticons have evolved now into emojis and, you know, plain old yellow smiley faces, you say.
Well, people want to make this into a big crusade on my part, and it's not.
But not a crusade, but you're not a fan.
I'm not a fan of the graphical emojis, no. I think it took a little bit of creativity to figure out how to make a smiling face out of just text characters. And then for a while, people were inventing more and more complicated ones, you know, Santa Claus and Abraham Lincoln and the Pope all being eaten by a python. I think one advantage of the text emoticons, or the very simple ones, is that it's just the essence of smile.
You are and have been a professor in the computer sciences for a long, long time. Here we are 30-something years later.
Yep.
And this appears to be at least a part of your legacy, right?
Well, I've reconciled myself to the idea that the first line of my obituary is going to be, you know, Scott Fullman, who invented the email smiley face and also made major contributions to artificial intelligence, passed away today. And depending how old I am, I guess there'll either be a smiley face or a frowny face on the on the tombstone.
We'll miss you when you're gone. Scott Fullman, he's a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, and I know this makes it two Amazon finals in a row, you guys, but you gotta hear this. The Financial Times is reporting that Amazon is going to pilot a program next month that will, wait for it, deliver packages directly to the trunk of your car. The catch is that your car has to be an Audi, and you have to live in Munich, Germany, and be an Amazon Prime member, but come on, right? Amazon says the DHL person will get one-time keyless access to your trunk, and better yet, that long-term they are going to make the service available to Prime members everywhere, perhaps even my car. That's all we got. The Dow up 88 points this Wednesday, 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 grows 10 points. That is 0.5% there as well. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.